Joe, how you doing?
Well, I guess I'm okay. I haven't been able to get my meds lately, so I'm getting a little nervous and tense, you know. But I'm seeing my psychiatrist tomorrow. Hopefully I can get a new prescription. Then I can become one of the 1 in 6 Americans who take psychotropic drugs. I'm just kidding. Actually, I wouldn't ever take those things. But it is sort of interesting that that psychiatry is becoming such a powerful force in our world. What can you tell me about psychiatry, Tim? What is it, for God's sakes?
Well, at best, it's a pseudoscience. At worst, it's psychological warfare. It's psychiatry itself is sort of a medicalization, an application of the medical model to psychology, I guess, is the quickest way to explain it. The idea that there's mental illnesses, these things that have really, there's no objective laboratory test for these things. No blood test you can take. There's not like you can find a bacteria or something or a virus or something that causes these things. It's all based on observed behavior and the subjective application of standards or perhaps one's view of certain types of behavior. And then they medicalize it. They apply the medical model to certain types of behavior. This is done in the diagnostic statistical model, which is sort of the Bible of psychiatry. And this enables the big pharma to market whatever poisonous or toxic concoctions they come up with to treat these so-called illnesses. And this isn't to say that people don't have coping problems or behavioral problems, even moral issues. A lot of the stuff, the behavior that people observe is because people's are acting in an immoral and incorrect fashion, or just in a different fashion in the way they cope with problems in their lives, certain trauma that they might have experienced. You just read briefly. A lot of today's psychiatry is based on, well, it's sort of they're a cadre of pill pushers, much like the medical industry in general, pushing drugs. And the big boost for psychiatry came in the 1970s when Big Pharma, I think it was around 1976, when they could have struck a deal. And Big Pharma would fund the medical journals, would fund the institutions, if psychiatry kind of got off the couch and just started dispensing pills. So that's been the trend in the last 40 years. It's just pushing pills to treat these problems that they ascribe to some sort of imbalance, chemical imbalance in the brain. The only problem is there is no standard for what's properly balanced. So how do they ever diagnose for an imbalance? Well, they're not. They're just throwing, creating a pretext or excuse to market these drugs. And so that's kind of what modern psychiatry is today. A lot of, I guess you could say a lot of jargon, right? A lot of fancy sounding jargon to make it sound technical and scientific. But it's anything but scientific if you really look into it. So that's my quick summation of psychiatry.
Right. A very good one, actually. I think that it's never been anything other than a weapon. I honestly believe that. I mean, I'm sure there have been some people in the history of what we call psychiatry that have been legitimate researchers and, you know, were just curious about what could be done with people who were in agony or were depressed. But in general, I just think it is... you know, it has its evil twin, which is psychological warfare. And I don't think that psychiatry has ever been anything other than an aspect of that. And there's kind of a very cute logical fallacy that I came across when I was doing research into this subject this week. And basically a professor of psychiatry, medical school, was asked about, you know, well, what tests can be done to determine, you know, if a certain mental disorder actually exists. And he said that if a test was required, then the approximately 300 disorders would be invalid. And he further stated that if people think a test is required, they are naive and illiterate regarding mental health and science. So perhaps they are themselves a victim of a mental disorder for asking the question. But I mean, this is, you know, just how it's been defended. And I want to say, the first thing I want to say is that the reason that it isn't just brought to an end tomorrow, because there is just so much malfeasance and so little success and so much damage, right? This, you can trace, you know, not just MK Ultra, but I mean, there are just dozens of examples of known malfeasance, which were done as under the guise of psychological experiments. There's just an incredible amount of damage that's been done with these psychotropic drugs. I mean, how many times there's a shooter of a mass, you know, mass killing, and the guy is on a psychotropic drug. So why isn't it brought to an end tomorrow, since there really isn't any evidence that it's making anybody better? Well, it's because people are intimidated. And this is the thing I really want to focus, you know, part of what I'm going to talk about tonight is just, we've got to stop being intimidated by it. You know, they have all of these words, and they have more, you know, alphabet soup, you know, they have like how many, the acronyms they have, post-traumatic stress disorder, they just have dozens of these things, literally dozens. But none of these things have any real clear clinical treatment that has, you know, statistical evidence saying, look, we can get you over this thing. So why do we even believe that these, first of all, that the disorder exists, Tim? And then secondly, why do we believe that the chemicals they want to give us will do anything for it?
Well, I think it stems to the fact that when they dispense these drugs, they're wearing white coats.
Yeah. That's right. We should take the white coats away.
And they have a lot of diplomas on their walls from these institutions. So it's an authority issue. We have a trust in these institutions and in these people that come from these institutions. You know, it's the same thing with medical doctors in many respects, although at least with medicine, there's something more concrete or physical you can sink your teeth into some of these things. With behavior, it's much less tangible. Again, this is coming off a more than a century of psychiatry. You could guess the father of modern psychiatry is Sigmund Freud, and if you examine his life, there is malfeasance. There's a malice intent there. It's profiteering. It's experimenting with drugs he did with patients. He did not want to make his patients better. He wanted to experiment with them and manipulate them and get money from them, and that is psychiatry. So Sigmund Freud really is the father of psychiatry in that respect. Psychoanalysis, you know, was there to, it's sort of a black op against civilization, Christian civilization at the time, justifying immorality, or at least he theorized that actual inhibition or morality, inhibition comes from morality in many respects, was part of the psychosis. And so the way you get over it was you relieve yourself of inhibition and liberate yourself, and that's how you properly cope with these things. If you examine Sigmund Freud's life, he had a lot of hang-ups and problems, poor health, a lot of sexual issues, and he just sort of just applied this to the society at large subtracted or any moral analysis of behavior, any moral, you know, judgment of these things. And a lot of people have attributed this to the fact that he was Jewish, and psychoanalysis has been described as sort of a Jewish black op against Christianity. And he himself used to say he imagines himself as a Latter-day Hannibal assaulting Rome.
Yeah, you know, that there's a lot of quotes from Freud that, you know, I kind of wonder about, like, you know, the Rothschild quote about, you know, if you give me control of the money, I don't care what makes the laws. And you look for the citation, you know, and it's just, where is the citation? But that quote is correct.
Yeah.
And the thing is that Freud, you know, I look at him as you say, you know, as an operation against Christian civilization, basically, is what Freud was fighting against. And his science is not, there's no science. I mean, it's just him talking to people on a couch and then coming to conclusions. But nothing can be, you know, inside the sort of the empirical method, and nothing can be basically put into the Socratic method, because Freud doesn't even talk to anybody. He just writes his ideas down. And then he gets picked up, you know, and by various, strands of the culture that becomes basically the counterculture. Probably the best known is Herbert Marcuse, and you know, his book Eros and Civilization, which I don't know if you've read, but was so powerful in the creation of the counterculture. Actually, the title was Eros and Civilization: A Philosophical Inquiry into Freud. Mm-hmm. And you know, Marcuse, you know, he accepted the reality of Freud's kind of understanding of the mind, and then he basically used that as the platform for, you know, stuff like polysexualism, end of personal hygiene. I mean, just letting it all hang out. He started, you know, in the book, he talks about the conflict that described by Freud. You know, where the repression, the superego, which is basically trying to input society's mores and norms, right? Now, in a Christian civilization, what would that be, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, he says that, you know, he says our civilization, which, you know, I think a clear way to say it, the Christian civilization is, generally speaking, founded on the suppression of instincts. Mm-hmm. Right. He wrote Our Civilization, but I don't know. Is it really Our Civilization? But anyway, he goes on and then he says, you know, but the price of the progress is the prevalence of guilt instead of happiness.
Yeah.
So then Marcuse, then he goes, he basically, I think, goes sophist. You know, he starts getting more and more, because he has the Freudian premise. But then he starts talking about how this should be applied to culture. And he talks that, you know, he says, in our culture, sex is allowed only for the betters, the capitalists and others in power, and for workers only when it is not disturbing his or her performance. Now, this is pretty funny, wouldn't you say, Tim, because he's actually writing this for the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, somehow they were all produced by, like, middle-class people who were somehow found time to have sex, right? I mean, that had to have happened, but the idea is that, you know, so Marcuse says that, you know, we need to, like, replace alienated labor, in other words, doing things that you don't want to do, with non-alienated libidinal work.
Yeah.
Okay, come hocus pocus for Eros, have just, you know, find a way to have like, well, work in the pornography business would be one way, I guess, you'd have non-alienated libidinal work.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, you know, it's really quite, when you look at it this way, it's quite dark.
Oh, yeah. It's evil. It's funny that there is a sense that feeling you get before the 60s, before the sexual revolution, people didn't talk about sex or have sex. Well, that's absurd. Look at the birth rates. You know, I don't know if these people ever had that talk with their parents, but you know, their problem was that people were having lots of sex in the late 40s and 50s and early 60s, but it was normative sex. It was within the confines of marriage for the most part and family, and therefore it was constructive and healthy sex, as opposed to, you know, being engaged in an orgy at a rock festival and, you know, somewhere, or these Dionysian rock festival, or you know, these things are ideas, they want to rip it away from any value, any normative values or meaning, and make it just a you know, sort of a carnival of a nihilistic or a self-indulgent carnival, literally.
Right. And so the family's being replaced.
Yeah.
And, you know, a culture of self-indulgence is coming into place. Marcuse's book is also seen, and basically his interpretation of Freud is seen and is cited everywhere as the beginning of gay liberation.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And of course, of course, psychiatry played a big part in normalizing that in the 70s.
Exactly. And so you wonder, well, you know, given that there is no science or empirical data to support any of the claims about homosexuality, about its place in one's mind, I think we can, you know, basically with good conscience call the statistics of Kinsey just completely, you know, nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
They've never been able to be replicated. So it's but all of this is then given to the American people to make them start to move in a different direction. One thing, you know, that I think is useful is to trace the Frankfurt School. I mean, I know I probably talked ad nauseum for our listeners about the Frankfurt School, but I think it's really important to understand psychiatry, to understand how the Frankfurt School links into psychiatry, because, you know, basically the authoritarian personality, which was created by the American Jewish Committee, who had hired the Frankfurt School, right, to create some science that would basically use Eros to this force of libido that Freud has described, liberate it, and then use it as propaganda to break apart the authority of the Christian culture, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's kind of like a good way to describe it. Okay, so I want to give an example of how you know that this is all that like Freud and the whole libido idea and the Eros that is being given to American culture by the Frankfurt School and the authoritarian personality, how you can really see that it's not even sincere, that it's actually clearly just a way of mental control over Christian culture. And that is that the founder of the Frankfurt School, before you had any of the mumbo jumbo from Freud, right, he had control, Gregor Luchas, that's not his real name, but he was given control over culture by Bella Kuhn, that's not his real name either, it's Kuhn. And you ended up with Luchas, you know, creating a sexually degenerate education system for young kids, and then coupling that with afternoon fairy tale reading to disassociate them from the personality that they had been developing in their family.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, these are not exaggerations. This is literally what's going on. I can even give you citations where Luchas even describes these things. But the point is, there you don't have this weird and specious justification of trying really to help anyone. There you see it's just completely presented as domination of culture, right? That's how Luchas presents it. So then when his organization, the Frankfurt School, which he founds and controls and creates the worldview of, then is hired by the American Jewish Committee. Tim, can I just so people, because I've been called on this, people wonder, well, what are you talking about with the Frankfurt School and all this? Can I just list their names so people can understand what I'm talking about?
Certainly.
Okay, it just takes a second. Okay, so the Frankfurt School, there's like 8 people in it. The ones who weren't in Army intelligence, that's Herbert Marcuse and Franz Neumann, who were brought into the OSS, right, where they did psychological research. Okay, they were the two that were not hired by the Frankfurt School because they were in the OSS. But the Frankfurt School then went out and hired Hedda Massing, Maria Joda, Morris Jankovic, Theodore Adorno, and they worked directly under Horkheimer. Okay, so that is, ladies and gentlemen, the Frankfurt School. This is who they are. this was basically a transplanted incarnation of the original Frankfurt School that had been brought to America by Rabbi Weiss for the express purpose of trying to find some way to basically transform Christian culture, because they were concerned about anti-Semitism, which was the claim of it. And it's interesting is that if you then kind of go forward, you can see that the Frankfurt School, the American Jewish Committee, bleeds directly into the Macy Conference, which is where, you know, you have the cybernetics, where this idea about programming the mind, suddenly you have psychology no longer as a therapy, but rather as it just being straightforwardly expressed as social control. And these people are in attendance, Horkheimer and Adorno. See, they are at this conference. Now, when I was doing reading about it, I found, you know, people have often said, well, you know, the Macy Conference, you know, it's what really is in back of it, you know? I mean, how do you know it wasn't legitimate science? And you know what? I found an amazing fact. I'll give it and then shut up. The Macy Conference was actually run by John Churchill at its onset. Now, who is he? He's Winston's cousin. Now, what is his background? Tim, he comes from British military intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gee whiz, the Macy Conference bills itself as this humanist organization, and yet you have, they hire as their executive officer an intelligence spook, right? See, it doesn't make any sense. So this is, you can kind of see the historical backdrop of psychiatry, because this is all going to lead directly from the Macy Conference into MKUltra. And MKUltra is where the drugs that are being given out today, you know, the serotonin and dopamine transformer, they all come right out of this research. The original thrust of the research, you know, can be understood by looking at Ewan Cameron, where, you know, he was trying to so-called de-pattern the mind of individuals. He claimed it was for therapy. But also, you have to look at his evil twin, who is, I think her first name was Lucretia, but it could have been Loretta Bender. Incredibly important person to understand. She was basically doing chemical electroshock and insulin shock, but with the same idea. In other words, these, just like Cameron, she said that she was trying to depattern the mind. Now, you got to think about the moral authority of this, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
With Cameron and Bender, they are literally taking the position that way will destroy the soul of the human, right? Because you had no, when they were done with you, there was no memory of self, right? I mean, this is how evil this group is. Bender was completely in tune with Cameron. She was getting money from MKUltra, as was Cameron. And then she was, this depatterning children. They don't even know how many she actually worked on. I mean, it's not even clear, but there were certainly hundreds of them. She wrote that, well, you know, the kids, they like being given LSD and put in dark rooms. Right. I'm not exaggerating. She actually would write that, well, you know, a great many of the kids had just wonderful experiences. You don't really get to know these individuals, but the fact of the matter is that a few of them actually wrote some testimony about it. what Bender wrote about it was that she says, in general, the children were happier. Their mood was high in the hour following the ingestion of LSD. Now, this is a very high dose of LSD. It's about five times what a normal person would take. And they were be giving it once a week, right? And she said they'd become more spontaneous and sometimes plays with balls and balloons, right? Right. So this is just this delightful little, these kids are stoned out and just having lots of fun. No problem. Well, you know, one guy, years later, a guy wrote about it, you know, and he had a little different perspective. His name was Chabinsky, and he, Ted Chabinsky, he was from a foster parents. They claimed that he may be schizophrenic, though they had no, you know, definition of that. But the social worker basically turned him over to Bender, and she began giving him LSD. And this was in 1955 at the Alfred Meyer Memorial. Which was part of Bellevue, right? So anyway, Chabinsky wrote that he said that I was one of the 300 children involved in an experimental program. I remember being dragged down a hallway screaming, thrown into a dark room. It made me want to die. I remember that they would stick a rag in my mouth so I wouldn't bite through my tongue and avoid the shock treatment. I wanted to die, but I didn't really know what death was. I knew it was something terrible. Maybe I was so tired that after that, I just didn't care what would happen to me. But the one thing I did was memorize my name. I taught myself to say my name, Teddy, Teddy, I'm Teddy. No matter what they did to me, I wasn't going to forget what my name was. That's Ted Chabinsky. He's actually has a Wikipedia page. And so, see, it's a little different, isn't it, Tim, than Bender's self-serving description of what went on with the kids.
Yeah, I guess he had a different interpretation of his own experience.
A little existential distinction.
It's interesting. He was pulled out of foster care. So this is an example of, again, not only the psychiatric institutions being corrupted or utilized by MKUltra, but also social services, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely.
To get vulnerable kids, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's really sad. I mean, what the hell can a person do? You know, if you're having mental problems, it's just so automatic to try to look to medical profession, to psychiatric help. But, you know, when you actually do research, all you can see is malevolence. So let me ask you, I think you can agree that there is at least some aspect of malevolence inside what we know of as psychiatry. How would someone approach their own situation, you know, where they're having some problems? I mean, what should someone do? I mean, obviously, we have all of the legal issues concerning the medical profession in America, but just from the position of the Socratic method, Jim, what would you suggest? You know, what does a person do?
Don't seek out an accredited psychiatrist, because they're not trained to treat you. They're trying to make you sicker. That's been the kind of the truth behind psychoanalysis from the beginning. I was reading an article called Sigmund Freud. It was on the New Nationalist website. And there's a quote from Dr. Jerome Frank of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, where he suggested that the therapy industry may be self-perpetuating and self-serving. And his quote is, "The greater the number of treatment facilities, the more widely they are known, the larger the number of persons seeking their services. Psychotherapy is the only form of treatment which, to some extent, appears to create the illness it treats." And the Israeli philosopher professor Yeshua Leibowitz went further and held that Freud's psychoanalysis was primarily a Jewish money-making scheme, and that's a bad sign for us, Jews. He went on to say that psychoanalysis was entirely in the hands of the Jews and was brought unspeakable suffering to millions of people. That's, you know, of course, a Jew saying that. So it's largely a Jewish operation. And again, we go back to what the malevolence is towards the larger host civilization, the Christian civilization, and it's another way that they've been able to morally subvert it through science and medicine or psychiatry, the same way that largely entertainment's been utilized to do that the same way. But, you know, so, I mean, I'm not saying that obviously the Jewish question is the answer to these things when it comes to modern psychiatry, but it's an important element we have to consider because you and I have both pointed out how the large Jewish element in MKUltra, which seems to be covered up, we always hear about Nazis, right? Nazis. And
Nazi this, Nazi that.
Nazi that. Yeah. But this is prominent.
And Masons, right. Jews and Masons.
Jews and Masons. And, you know, that's, you know, okay, that's great. So, you know, cover that important element of it up. But so it is malevolent. It's malevolent. It's a form of psychological warfare and cultural culture creation or manipulation. It bleeds into advertising. Of course, Edward Bernays, the twin nephew, double nephew of Sigmund Freud, applied a lot of these things to marketing. And marketing is a form of psychological warfare. And many of his stuff were many of his I guess his strategies, marketing strategies, were openly malevolent. He's also utilized by the national security state to promote wars, support the national security state, to create fear in these things. I think in the 1950s, the hide under your desk thing was a Bernays idea, just to spread terror. It served no, you know, civil defense purpose, because hiding under your desk wasn't going to protect you from a nuclear blast. As far as where does someone to seek out help in these things? I think the important thing is I mean, there is some legitimate scientific study of human behavior, and there are valid classifications for behavior that we all develop classifications to understand the natural world. You know, that's fine. But nevertheless, you have to. People who have coping problems, behavior problems, have to be able to, you know, talk it out. You know, therapy, I guess you could say, couch time, you could say. But there's a you know, you've heard of Peter Bregan?
Yeah.
Peter, toxic psychology. He has developed called empathy care, I think it's called, where, you know, people's problems, they don't resort to drugs and these things, which he, in excruciating detail, cites the, you know, they call them side effects, or just the effects of these drugs, the horrible brain damage they cause to the nervous system and these things. Hundreds of thousands of people harmed and killed by these drugs a year. It gets covered up. Media doesn't report it because the big pharma sponsors the major news outlets. But the idea is kind of just to talk with these people and try to establish some sort of empathy and God forbid, apply some sort of moral component to the analysis, as opposed to this scientist approach where it's all drugs and chemicals, chemical imbalances, and happiness can be, you know, can be created through psychotropic pharmaceutical applications in these things. And it all goes back to, I guess, when it goes back to even, you know, the moral mindset or the lack thereof, just the whole mindset of like someone like a Ewan Cameron depatterning these things, wiping the brain clear in these things. They have no recognition of the soul, the spiritual element of human beings. It's all just chemicals. And it's just a very materialistic, cold, and ultimately, I think, an incorrect view of human beings.
Yeah, I think that they have an idea about the soul. They just want to kill it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's really what that is. And you know, as far as like the, you know, the new classes of drugs that treat all these different things, I mean, what I have learned about them and believe about them is that what they do actually is damage the brain, so that, you know, what they're trying to do, they have this hypothesis that maybe schizophrenia is caused because you have too much dopamine. Mm-hmm. So then they basically have one of the functions of the antipsychotics is to block dopamine, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is the brain, the body, always reacts against these kinds of artificial stimulations. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you'll then increase the density of your dopamine receptors, right? So the drug is self-defeating. And this happens just every which way in the brain drugs. Serotonin uptake enhancers, dopamine blockers, they all, over a period of time, they induce the abnormality that has been hypothesized to cause the disorder. So even if they knew what they were doing about the disorder, which they don't, the chemicals are really basically antithetical to the theory that they're trying to give the thing, you know, to the kid or the adult under, the theory that they're trying to use. But I was just going to go back to your point, which is that, look, life is tough. And what they say is, well, I mean, people are saying, like Bergen, you're talking, he says, well, you know, there's these coping mechanisms that people will learn naturally if you don't let them have drugs. Yes, that's correct. That's called maturity.
Yeah.
That's called growing up. And when you interfere with growing up with these antipsychotics, you don't end up with a more mature or seasoned or confident soul, you see.
Especially if you give a drug to a 12-year-old and his brain's exactly. rapidly growing. Yeah.
I'll just give you a little some statistics. 1.5 million kids under 8 are on antipsychotics of some kind.
That's a crime. It's bad enough for giving them to fully grown adults, right? But yeah. giving to 8-year-old children? I mean, what behavior do you observe in an 8-year-old that you would lead you to believe that you'd give them some sort of psychotropic drug?
Well, there's a psychiatric phobia. It's a fear of going to the doctor's office to get the jab. You know, I mean, it's so it's just a lump of malevolence, and it's just, okay, so psychiatry is just an aspect of psychological warfare. I mean, I think the amount of science inside this thing is, is really tiny. And if there is good science, and I'm sure there are legitimate researchers, look, they don't have any impact. And I can actually demonstrate this because, you have all of this malevolence, like, Loretta Bender, Yoon Cameron, Freud. And then let's we can talk at length about MKUltra,
Well, that's another thing. And the important point, the biggest indictment of psychiatry is it's how integrated it was to MKUltra.
Exactly. Yeah. But here's my point. No one in the field called the field.
Joe? You there?
Okay.
We're recording again. Sorry, got cut off.
Okay, we got cut off, but I'll just go on and say that you have dozens of examples of felonious malfeasance, right? Dozens of hundreds and hundreds of kids and humans were given drugs unwittingly. There's just examples of this all over the place. And yet no one in the field of psychiatry ever came forward and said, we've got to atone for this. And the way we do that is looking inside ourselves in terms of, what is wrong with our profession morally, right? Mm-hmm. That's just an obvious, straightforward thing to do. Now, why didn't that not happen? Well, it's because they don't want anyone to look inside the field, because mm-hmm. then they would see that in fact, there's malevolence. And so since we know that malevolence is afoot, and they never have come forward with some kind of, public declaration about it and also invitation to the public to come inside and to look at the moral structure of the thing, then we know that it's still functioning, that the MKUltra, control that then basically, goes out and becomes part of the counterculture, the people who are inside the MACI conference and involved with MKUltra are creating the capacity and the knowledge of how to program human beings, right? So this is going on, and no, they simply don't want us to recognize it, right? That this is really what, you know, I mean, is just as is completely clear from the data, is that they are using their psychological science not to heal anybody, but to control society. And so, you know, since we know they have an atone, we know that we're dealing with a real problem. But then, you know, this comes back to what someone's supposed to do. Well, you know, I'll just underline what you said. You know, just the first thing you need to do is try to look inside yourself and see, you know, what you can do to grow up and grow past, you know, the trauma or whatever it is that is basically, you know, not letting you function normally.
Yeah, that one thing is maturity and also erudition, because if you did you're suffering anxiety or you're frustrated with life, and of course if you avail yourself of literature, a knowledge study of history, these things, you realize, at least not to take it personally, this is indeed the human condition, and you develop a sort of a philosophical outlook on life, which is the first step, perhaps even a spiritual outlook, which helps you cope with these things, and also you don't get a sense of entitlement, the whole notion that you're entitled to happiness, right? You're not entitled to happiness. You live your life to do what's right, and they may not make you immediately happy. But that's, again, we live in a very consumerist, I want it now culture, which is all part of, which again is a part of psychological warfare, brought to you by courtesy Edward Bernays, nephew of Sigmund Freud. So it's all about psychological manipulation. But the malevolence, there's a good summation here. We're talking about MKUltra and the psychiatry. Dr. Colin Ross, who's written a book called Military Mind Control and Project Bluebird. But in this article, he's summarizing his book. He goes, my book, CIA Doctors, is based on 15,000 pages of documents I received from the CIA through the Freedom of Information Act and dozens of papers published in medical journals. These papers report the results of research funded by Air Force Office of Scientific Research, Department of the Army, Office of Naval Research, and the CIA. From 1950 to 1972, the CIA funded top-secret research at many leading universities, including Harvard, Yale, Cornell, Johns Hopkins, and Stanford. There was a series of CIA mind-control programs, including Bluebird, Artichoke, MKUltra, MKSearch, MKNaomi. MKUltra and related programs had several overlapping purposes. One was to purchase mind-control drugs from suppliers. Another was to form relationships with researchers who might later be used as consultants at the top secret level. The core purpose of these programs was to learn how to enhance interrogations, erase and insert memories, create and run Manchurian candidates. All of this is described clearly and explicitly in declassified CIA documents, which provide a glimpse into the tip of the iceberg of CIA and military mind control. The CIA mind control experiments were interwoven with radiation, chemical, biological weapons experiments conducted on children, comatose patients, pregnant women, the general population, and other unwitting groups who had no idea they were subjects in the secret experiments. Radiation, bacteria, funguses were all released over urban areas. A large cloud of radiation was released over Spokane during Operation Green Run. Plutonium was injected into comatose patients in Boston by Dr. William Sweet, a member of the Harvard Brain Electrode Team. Plutonium is placed in the cereal of mentally handicapped children at the Fernald School in New England. 751 pregnant women were injected with plutonium at Vanderbilt University. Bacteria Serratia marisens was released into the air in San Francisco, resulting in a series of infections. And plutonium was injected into the atmosphere at University of Rochester. All these experiments were conducted without any informed consent or meaningful follow-up. Hallucinogens, marijuana, amphetamines, and other drugs were administered to imprison narcotic addicts in Lexington, Kentucky, terminal cancer patients at Georgetown University Hospital, hospitalized sex offenders at Iona State Hospital in Michigan, and Johns picked up by prostitutes hired by the CIA in San Francisco and New York. Most of these experiments were conducted by the psychiatrists with top secret clearances. These included Louis Jolyon West, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at University of Oklahoma, and later at UCLA, Dr. Robert Hyde in Boston, Dr. Carl Rogers at the University of Wisconsin, Dr. Martin Oren at Harvard, Dr. Charles Osgood at the University of Illinois, Dr. James Hamilton at Stanford, Dr. Charles Geschechter at University of Richmond, Dr. Harold Abramson and Dr. Harold Wolf at Cornell. Other top secret cleared MKUltra contractors included Dr. Maitland Baldwin, a neurosurgeon at the National Institute of Health, and Dr. Carl Pfeffer, a pharmacologist at Emory. And so, and all this violated medical codes, and going back to, you know, he says the CIA doctors violated all medical codes of ethics dating back to Hippocrates, including the Nuremberg Code.
Exactly. And that's the key, is that the Hippocratic Oath is just a PR stunt to get the public to buy into this nonsense. Because if the Hippocratic Oath was actually in motion in the psychiatric profession, I have the list here of all of the institutions and individuals that were, you know, take part of it, and then I have some relations that I can show, but I'm not going to bother with it. It's hundreds of people, Tim, hundreds of institutions. Nobody blew the whistle on this thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody did. And this is that very often you're talking about, you can read in the documents that the patients are unwitting, right? They don't know that the experiment, the real purpose of the experiment, right? So the Hippocratic Oath is breached, and you can't look to it as something that is going to protect the patient from the psychiatrist, right? The real thing that has to go on, and if there is, I hope there are psychiatrists listening to us tonight, contact us, is that what we really need is a citizens' committee to try to determine how to protect clients from psychiatrists, right? There is just such a pattern of malevolence here that has never been atoned to. No one ever came forward. You have hundreds and hundreds of psychiatrists that just threw the Hippocratic Oath out the window. So why should the public believe anything that these people say? Well, we don't. We can't. You simply can't. Not there's just too much data, right, showing that they're organized against us. That they're basically experimenting on us. We have to, you know, find a way to publicize this fact and to set up citizen review, I don't know, committees of some kind to try to get a system in place that we can protect ourselves from psychiatrists and from the psychiatric profession.
We have to, I mean, look at their credentials as being instead of being in awe of their credentials or looking at their credentials as some sort of certification of expertise and competence, is actually an indictment.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just like getting back to the question I had, you know, where the guy asked the psychiatrist for some evidence, and the psychiatrist responds, well, if you even have to ask, you could be putting the whole thing in jeopardy. Well, yeah, that's exactly what we want. We want the whole thing to basically be not believed in, and we want to stop the intimidation. You know, you talked earlier about, you know, they've got white coats on and they have a title and they have legal power, but none of that has anything to do with good medicine, with healing, right? So we have to expose the psychiatric sort of community to be seen as something that is still in control of MKUltra, that has never made atonement, that has basically gone on and developed all of the elements that the Macy Conference foresaw in the future, that it wanted to develop, that all this talked about Brady, all of these things are coming to pass. Mm-hmm. And we have to simply assume that, I mean, what other assumption can we make but that these guys are either, you know, if they are a weak-minded psychiatrist, they're just being herded along, or if they're inside the deal, they're just as evil as rattlesnake. But in either case, there's no good medicine, or there's no there's no warrant even that when you go into that environment that you're going to be dealing with someone that is trying to give you good medicine. You know, it's sort of like when you go to a pediatrician and you learn that he's going to get $500 bonus if he can talk you into getting your kid 66 vaccinations. Mm-hmm. You as a parent, you have to assume that you're dealing with someone who has, you know, is not operating in the context of the Hippocratic Oath, but rather basically is a drug pusher, right? I mean, he's just there to sell, you know, there's no, so the first thing we have to do is to break up the intimidation, you know, is to break up the mindset that the parent has or someone, you know, who has a family member and they're having mental problems, to think that you have an option with psychiatry that is going to honestly and you know, give good science and good medicine to help the person get better. I mean, it just, as far as I can tell, there is just nothing. The drugs don't work. The kind of philosophical, you know, speech therapy stuff like analysis and transactional and all the different neo-Freudian ideas, these are just cultural dominations. These are just, you know, take your culture and forget about it and go out and you know, have as many sexual encounters as you want. You're going to be healthier if you do. I mean, there's nothing there. You see, it doesn't, nothing is being offered that I can see that is worth any money and is worth even any time or even worth any giving any hope toward that. Well, gee, if I go in there and they prescribe Prozac for me, I'm, you know, a year from now, I think I'm going to be better. No, a year from now, your brain's going to be shot. You're going to screw up all of the serotonin uptake potential inside your brain. You're going to be far worse off. What you really want to do is find the strength inside yourself to deal with these problems and get past them. Grow up. You know, that's what you need to do. And our culture, if we would just focus on that, as we used to do, right, before the psychiatrist replaced the parent, this would be a huge step toward, you know, going back in a better direction.
Well, that's because in the prior generations, people knew that they belonged to something, and so they weren't, you know, they weren't confused or lost. But the whole idea of the toxic culture is to create a bunch of atomized, confused individuals to the point that they're not even sure what sex they are anymore. And that's going to create a whole host of behavioral disorders or problems or coping problems that will then, you know, this will send these people into the loving arms of the psychiatrist for treatment. Then they'll dispense the drugs. I mean, good example, we've talked about this before, is the environment of the college campus. It creates anxiety, depression, these things. And any object, you know, just a quick examination of a freshman, you know, a college freshman, alienated from, you know, he's a long way from home, he's in an unfamiliar environment, maybe he or she isn't doing well academically because the his secondary education wasn't enough to get him ready for college, maybe they're partying, they're doing things, this is particularly true with females, feeling guilty about some ways they're behaving, so they're getting depressed, and all of a sudden they go to talk to someone, a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and they put them on drugs. And so at the point now you have 25% of all college students on some sort of drug.
I think it's harder than that. And let me tell you something. I'm just going to make a public challenge, Tim. I want to find someone. And I've tried this because I had kids not too long ago. They were in college, and I tried to find this theoretical person, but I couldn't. So I'm going to ask tonight that maybe the audience can help. I want to find one student that went to a college shrink with some problems and wanted them to give them serotonin uptake like a Prozac or, you know, an antidepressive or Adderall, you know, so they could concentrate better and was turned down. I want to find one kid that said, you know, I really wanted the drug, but the shrink said no. I want to find that kid. Because you see, I think that the whole thing is just a lump of malevolence. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there is that kid doesn't even exist. I don't think there is a kid out there. I think that every single kid that wants Adderall, which is basically, you know, methadrine or benzedrine, or who wants, you know, Prozac, which is basically a kind of LSD virtually, mm-hmm. it just fiddled with your serotonin. That has the psychiatrist that goes, you know, I really think you want to, you should grow up. You know, why don't you try grow up?
Yeah.
And see if that works. See if you can actually get over these emotional problems just by developing some grit, right? I want to find that person. I want to find the student, because when I looked, I could. When I looked at the universities that my kids were going to, 100% of the kids that wanted those drugs were given them.
Yeah. Well, that's the business model. There's the psychiatrist's office is there to dispense drugs. I mean, the whole training, and that goes back to that deal that was made back in the 70s. And so that's what they're trained to do, and they do it. And they may even think they're doing good at some point. A few of them may even think that, but they're not. But yeah, the good question is, yeah, we can look at we can follow the money, and obviously trillions of dollars are at stake here. So obviously Big Pharma's not going to fess up to all the horrible effects of their drugs, the higher suicide rate, the damage it does to the brain, these things. They're not going to acknowledge these things. But to what extent is today's, you know, I would say the standard treatment psychiatry, is that a conscious implementation of MKUltra, given MKUltra's objectives in the 50s and 60s about, you know, producing drugs that were... I was reading an article by John Rappaport, and he made this point about MKUltra. He says, in modern psychiatry or today's psychiatry, because the CIA wanted to find substances that would promote illogical thinking and impulsiveness. Serious consideration should be given to the idea that psychiatric medications would eventually satisfy that requirement. The CIA wanted to find chemicals that would produce signs and symptoms of recognized disease in a reversible way. This suggests many possibilities, among them, use drugs to fabricate diseases and thereby give false impression of germ-caused epidemics. CIA wanted to find drugs that would promote amnesia, ideal for discrediting whistleblowers. CIA wanted to discover drugs which would produce paralysis of the legs, acute anemia. CIA wanted to develop drugs that would alter personality structure and these things. What MKUltra really is sort of an expression of cybernetics, the manipulation and control of society, you know, through technology and these things. And they're doing this through psychiatry because they're fundamentally changing people's behavior, making them weaker and more dependent. And that, you know, as you alluded to, that's something what Aldous Huxley talked about in Brave New World through the Soma pill, right? I mean, this is the agenda.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I could, and it would be really long-winded, but I could actually walk from 1909 to the present, and I could show that, like, you know, you've got military intelligence in Britain that's being funded with Rockefeller money to basically look at eugenics and different ways to control undesirable. And this would be Marlboro Churchill, the same guy who then ends up in the Macy Conference running it. You look at pre-Hitler era, right? Here you have the Kaplan Institute, which is sort of a precursor to all of these ideas. It's in Germany. It's talking about, the idea of psychiatry with race purification, race betterment. And who's funding this, right? Well, this is being funded, guess what, by, this is James Loeb, and this is a Warburg, right? Mm-hmm. And then when they transfer, it changes its name, but it's the same organization, the same doctors. A lot of them end up back in MKUltra, and the Rockefellers take over. Standard Oil, that's who's funding it, right? Mm-hmm. And so then when you get into the 30s, again, you're looking at the Macy Conference, which is basically using Rockefeller family psychologists and hires General Marlboro Churchill. Remember the guy I was referring to earlier? They're interested basically in simply social engineering. And now you get into, guess what? The Freemasons, mm-hmm. right? 34. This is where, with Rockefeller money, the Scottish Rite went into all of this. They were interested in schizophrenic research, right? And this actually led to the LSD experiments in the 40s, the late 40s. So it was all through the Scottish Rite, Rockefeller money. These people are all completely interrelated. You have Columbia University working with the German scientists that are already starting to filter over from this so-called Kaplan Institute, and they're working on all these projects to create drugs, right, that will control the mind. And now, but what's interesting is that this all ends up, you know, when you get MKUltra, what really happens to it? Well, you know, the thing that I find so interesting, you go through it all and you get into Tavistock and, you know, you can see all this stuff, but this ends up not so much with the counterculture. It ends up with Silicon Valley. This is where it all ends up. I mean, when you look at like these games, you know, that are kind of these war games, you know, that people play on TV and stuff, mm-hmm. this is really kind of the current, you know, is Burning Man and these kinds of games that are being developed through Silicon Valley. But this is all through the cybernetics group. The cybernetics group, which comes directly from Macy, which has members of the American Jewish Committee, and it has these, Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead, the same cast of character mm-hmm. that we've had over and over again, is developing, the capacity to program the mind. John von Neumann and Norbert Wiener, they talk about programming the mind. Harold Abramson is sitting there with them. He then goes directly to create, you know, the MKUltra experiments, which are using LSD, right? But what happens to all this? Well, you know, it all ends up, Tim, where you get the artificial intelligence with the idea of controlling the mind through, computers, right? So when you look at your iPhone, when you switch on to Facebook or, you know, you use Google, man, I'm telling you, you'd better be careful, because just in the same way as the people in the past didn't really understand the mind control that was being applied to them, they thought that there was, you know, kind of a benevolent purpose. Boy, it's too long-winded to go into the whole chain of all these events, Tim, but I'm telling you, it's completely direct and it's absolutely observable. And you end up with the, LSD proponents meeting the hackers into the human mind. And the first one that they rolled out was Stuart Brand mm-hmm. was with it. It was called Space War. And the idea was that you'd be locked in a life and death space combat for hours at a time. And, this would just be wonderful. But it's just really, this is just like the sex and violence video games that we're experiencing today. So, you know, they are definitely organizing everything to control our mind. You know, Sargent wrote The Battle for the Mind, I believe it's called. And he, you know, is kind of a limited hang-up, but he was really, I think, very accurate. The mind is really what is being fought for today. You know, this is really being fought for. It's what's being attacked. And those of us who have minds, Tim, we have to be careful, because they're not safe out there.
Yeah. No, they're not. And this sort of psychotronic warfare is particularly creepy and frightening, because they can get into your mind, perhaps, and voice to skull technology you read about in these things, and you can do this to harass or to drive people insane who might present a problem to the agenda. But yeah, you mentioned, you know, obviously you mentioned Margaret Mead and Bates, and that's weaponized anthropology.
Yeah.
And through weaponized anthropology, you can developed the weapon of weaponized psychiatry and drugs, because it's the weaponized anthropology which creates the toxic environment where people become alienated and confused or despondent or depressed, and that's when you corral them into the psychiatric institutions or or practices, and that's where they dispense the drugs, which dull the mind, you know, which control the mind. And to the point now it's become so normalized, and it really is normalized. You hear the expression, hey, she, you know, she's off her meds, as if,
yeah,
you know, that's the problem. And TV shows, you know, TV shows like The Sopranos or rather artfully promote this stuff. Because in that show you have a mob, you know, a mob boss who's suffering anxiety and panic attacks, and he's in the whole, you know, the whole thing is he sought the help of a psychiatrist to deal with this stuff. That's sort of the backdrop to the story, and he talks about his problems, and you're watching the show, and the psychiatrist is a typical psychiatrist, and you know, she has some sort of moral outlook because she's not a criminal. She's not a gangster. He is. And so you have these two worlds meeting. But at the end of the day, she's giving him Prozac and drugs to deal with his anxiety, when it's clear his panic attacks and anxiety are derived from his childhood trauma, because his father was a mobster, and he witnessed crimes and violence, and the fact that he feels guilt about his life. And that's never really addressed in the show, because in order to acknowledge what he's doing, he had to fundamentally morally reassess his life and fundamentally change his life. And he's not willing to do that. And the psychiatrist broaches that, but she, at the end of the day, she's just giving him drugs to deal with his problems. And the drugs are presented as a solution. In the later episodes, even his son goes on it, and everyone's kind of on drugs in this show. It's promoted as normal. And that's considered normal. That's considered normal.
Yeah, well, I mean, instead of just telling him when to stop killing people, maybe you feel better.
Yeah. Or you know, he's Catholic, go to confession or something. But
yeah, I'm sorry, it was like the weak joke I made at the beginning, where I was trying to make the suggestion that I'm off my med, so that's why I'm feeling bad. I mean, everyone, this has just become part of the everyday culture. Is that the meds? Well, I mean, 1 in 6 American adults are on meds. That's the statistic I have.
And it's because they wouldn't consider themselves mentally ill, because there's a stigma to that. What they say, it takes the edge off, or it cures their anxiety about, well, maybe you should feel anxiety about something in your life, right? Maybe you should feel upset about it. Maybe you should feel depressed or upset about some aspect of your life, because they're acknowledging a problem. You mean, if you leave a funeral, you should be a little depressed or saddened by it. You shouldn't be happy, you know? And so maybe there are circumstances in your life that you need to change to make you feel better.
Yeah, or maybe you need to develop a little bit of grit.
Yeah.
You know, whatever that means, like grow up so that you have the maturity to like deal with these emotions and continue to be, you know, morally upright and have a solid consciousness, even though life is tough.
And there's a quote that goes, all mental illness begins with the avoidance of necessary suffering.
Yeah, that's a great insight. Yeah. That, I would say like all wisdom is the understanding of that fact. I mean, yeah. You know, looking just in my life, and I know I'm not a good example of anything, but I will just put it out there that the suffering, you know, at different times is what actually enabled me to go through it, to understand it, try to rise above it. You know, this is whatever character I have and whatever success I have achieved in life is completely related to the fact that I was sober when I went through the really hardest time.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't, it's sort of like, I know in AA, I've never been to AA, but I mean, I've talked to people who've been there, and they say that the one thing that an alcoholic has to have is an understanding that they haven't matured at all, that the drug was basically, that the maturation process that a human goes through is stopped totally with the narcotic. And I think this is 100% true with all of the meds, right? So just be aware, when you take the med, what you're saying is, I'm not going to become my best self. Because if you want to be your best self, you need to mature. You need to develop strength of character. You cannot ever do this with meds. It's the exact opposite. You need to be sober when you go through the hard times.
Yeah.
This is the only state that has the grace, to use the word, which enables the soul after the experience, right? When you've gone through the tough time and you've, you know, with full conscious awareness experienced it, and then come to the end and been able to say, well, I'm past it, or I was able to change my behavior, or something is, you know, to be in the other side of it, you are now much more mature. If you use drugs, you will never mature, because the brain will never develop this sort of understanding and belief in self. This is the thing. When you take the drug, you believe in the drug. When you go through the tough times and you fight your way through it, you develop some confidence in yourself.
Well, that was in the 60s when they thought you could take a shortcut through enlightenment or spiritual enlightenment through LSD.
Yeah,
you know, well, these things, yeah, that was the con, I guess. But through suffering you develop wisdom and also empathy. And I think if you take a drug to avoid suffering, anxiety, you lose the capacity for empathy and you become a de facto psychopath, or sociopath. And that's kind of how they're sort of creating higher rates of sociopathology by medicating everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. What I think, Tim, is, I mean, hate to use the term, but satanic.
Yeah.
I mean, the drugs basically are a way of destroying the soul. That's really what they do.
Mm-hmm.
When you get in there and you change your dopamine and serotonin structures, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that is part of the deepest self, you see.
Did you ever see the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
No.
It's a movie about, made about 15 years ago, Kate Winslet and what's that comedian? Jim Carrey, in a dramatic role. And it's the idea, there's a doctor that has the ability to erase unpleasant memories from your brain so you can relieve of the trauma of that bad memory. And the movie kind of plays out how people who, you know, it shows his office, the people who have pets have died, so they make them forget the pet. Loved ones who died, make them forget the loved one, or some unfortunate, you know, experience in their life, whether it's an accident or a death or a relationship or something. And at the end of the movie, the people find themselves repeating the same mistakes over and over again because they don't have the experience or wisdom from the bad experience. End up doing the same thing over and over again. And there's this one thing in the movie. The idea is that too bad, there's something to be gained by experiencing these things, wisdom, I guess you could say. But the doctor, one of the patients is asking a doctor, he says, what does it cause brain damage, the treatment? And he goes, well, technically it is brain damage. But at the end of the day, people don't move on or don't develop. There's an arrested development that occurs because they never grow up, because they don't have the experience. And so the idea is that these whether it's a breakup or something, or even a death, these things, it's a part of life, and you don't run away from them. You experience them in a way you embrace them. And a healthy response is to understand that this is indeed a part of living, and not this idea that it's all sunshine and lollipops in life.
Well, exactly right. And the thing is, you know, they are trying to destroy the soul, because the soul is what can rebel.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can get you to accept the lollipop world, you can end up as a mimic of Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
But you're not ever going to be someone with any kind of mature presence, real soul development. And so it's, you know, anytime a psychiatrist dispenses something that affects brain chemistry, I just hate to say it, but I just think it's satanic. Mm-hmm. I mean, honest to God, satanic. I mean, and I don't think there are many psychiatrists that are unaware of the real effects of the chemicals. I just can't believe they're that stupid. I just think that there are some which are intimidated, that just go along to get along. But a lot of them actually know that they are just, you know, turning the people into mental vegetables. Just think about, you know, Loretta Bender and Cameron, you know, think about that moral authority to basically de-pattern.
Yeah, but you and Cameron wasn't a big name in psychiatry. He was sort of like on the fringes, right?
Right. Yeah, he was a fringe. he was the head of he was the president of every major psychological. One thing, when I was reading through this, I had no idea. I knew he was the president of, like, the World Psychiatric Convention. Cameron was also the head of the American Psychiatric Association, the Canadian Association, and two others. He was the number one psychiatrist in the world. I mean, in any, by any criteria. And Bender, you look today, Google like award, Loretta Bender Awards. Dozens of them pop up. They use her name everywhere. Here's someone who was bragging about depatterning the minds of children, right? And then, of course, reading some of the documentation that the people went through the experience. So there is something really, really sick inside of psychiatry. There, it's just something that's really evil. And so, you know, when you have problems and the psychiatrist is available, man, I don't know good from bad. The one, you have to make an existential choice. Everyone has to make their own decisions. But please be aware, you know, that it could just be that, that, you know, you could be walking into Ewan Cameron or Loretta Bender. Because remember, the institution of psychiatry has never disavowed these individuals.
Yes. Right? So what's that say about it? Yeah.
So what does that say about who's still in control?
And that's another thing is people have to stop sort of being, like you said, being intimidated by these large institutions and names. And just because a name is on a bridge or on a building, the J. Edgar Hoover Building or the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, doesn't mean they're people we should respect or emulate or think we're great people. That's the way the system is. And that's another thing people have a hard time understanding is just the widespread corruption in society of these institutions. I read a list off of universities that were involved in this, Stanford, Harvard, Yale. Most people respect these institutions. If you go there, you want to jog around in a Yale. If you go to Yale Law, Harvard Law, you buy a sweatshirt that says Harvard or Yale on it so you can tell people you went to these institutions. That should be the case. These institutions should be, they should be called out for what they really are.
Right? And you got to pay $70,000 a year. Yeah. And then if you're the parent, you get to go to the homecoming game the first year and you get a sweatshirt.
Yeah.
And that's what you get. And then your kid gets 4 years of cultural Marxism.
Yep. And where they're, at least a quarter of them are put on drugs because they're following, in essence, they're following Freud's advice at the university by getting rid of inhibition and being free.
So, yeah. Because I was inarticulate, I have the data here. Cameron was the president of the Canadian, American, and World Psychiatric Associations, as well as the American Pathological Association and the Society of Biological Psychiatry. He was the Colossus of Rhodes, right? Mm-hmm. So when he depatterns hundreds of people and kills people, right? Actually murders them. Well, I think the institution of psychiatry should come forward with a little hand-wringing, maybe a little contrition, something to help the public regain confidence in it, but nothing, right? Nothing. And you know what? Let me tell you something. I mean, just one thing that really bugs me is that when Cameron got called on his depatterning, you know, the lawsuits happened and the people brought all the evidence forward and the CIA settled up for some unknown amount. They say it's like around $60 million. Okay. His associates at the institution at McGill, they were said, what the hell were you doing? What were you thinking of? And you know what their answer was? They go, well, you know, it was, I guess it was bad science, but he meant well. He was really trying. Okay. Well, you know how you know they're just lying right through their teeth? Is because it is the fact that he was getting money from MKUltra. They were experiments. It wasn't therapy. It was experiments. That's what the guy was doing. It's completely self-evident because the money was being funded through MKUltra that these were experiments. It wasn't therapy. So this was... you know, this is the intimidation of underling psychiatrists or the sophistry of psychiatrists that are in on the deal, trying to, you know, make a happy face for the public. But in either case, if you're someone who's thinking of using the service, right, the institution as a service for medicine, man, you got to be aware of what the tradition and the history of the thing is. Right. Mm-hmm. You have to be aware of what the reality of the thing is. You're not walking in. You know, the guy's going to have like diplomas on the wall and a smile on his face. And at the end of the day, you know, after like $4,000 or $5,000, he's going to write a prescription for a drug. Man, do some research. Some research into the history of the institution of psychiatry. Do some research into the lack of any evidence for the syndrome that the guy with the smile is going to come up with, and then do some research into the drug, right? What are the long-term effects to the receptors of the serotonin uptake in the brains when you take this crap? And what you'll see is this guy is a snake oil salesman. And Tim, bear in mind, the original snake oil salesmen were the Rockefellers.
Yes, literally.
And they weren't kidding. They were selling snake oil.
Yeah.
Before oil, it was snake oil. But then they went ahead and funded all this stuff. So when the guy is sitting there and he goes, "Hey, well, here's your prescription for Prozac," man, just think snake oil.
Yeah, and it is all petrochemically based.
Yeah.
You know, so which is ultimately incompatible with the body. So.
Yeah, it's chemicals.
Yeah, it's chemicals.
You aren't going to ever find a soul that is more at peace and has greater strength by taking artificial chemicals, things putting into your body that actually distort the natural brain.
So you're saying I should stop taking my morning teaspoon of Nujol?
Yeah.
Every morning, Nujol. Come here, kids. Get your Nujol.
A speedball of cocaine and morphine. You know, they're just, I hate to say it, but they're just, you know, there are no chemicals really you should be putting in the body. And if I had a family member that was having mental problems, the first thing I would do is I would say, you know, let's look at your diet. What are you putting in your body?
Well, that's the big thing that people don't realize is that just the toxic, there's so many factors, the toxic diet. And I know I've heard anecdotal cases of people just improving depression, even migraines, these things with diet.
Absolutely. And exercise and diet. Go to an all-organic diet. Get rid of every single chemical.
And some people are more sensitive to these things.
Yeah, no sugar. Yeah. Nothing that has chemical.
Well,
sugar
is a big thing. The sugar trust.
The worst thing.
The sugar trust. It's been a conspiracy since the 1890s to just deluge the American people with sugar and everything. Because then the non-fat kick in the 70s was a big sugar conspiracy, because what they did was, and they got rid of fat in the food, this diet stuff, they increased sugar to increase the flavor. And then the worst thing is sugar substitutes, the sweeteners, which is even worse than sugar. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, all the synthetic oils. I mean, forget that crap. Have real, if you're going to use anything, use butter, organic milk, and then organic fruits and vegetables. And you'll see in like 2 weeks, you don't need your Prozac.
See now you're deconstructing. You're taking apart the entire business model of the New World Order is well, diet, food, everything. It's like, you know, and you can see glimpses of it because of what they've had to shut down, like. They had to shut down hemp, you know, and these things.
Yeah.
Because that can be used for clothing materials, even medicinal purposes and these things. Even ethanol, they shut, you know, originally you didn't, gasoline was competing with oil, you know, vegetable-based oils for fuel in these things. And they had to shut that down. And that's one of the reasons why Rockefeller backed prohibition.
Yeah.
Was absolutely. It made that, it, you know, because then... it made a law that you had to put an additive into it, which was petroleum based, which made it more expensive than gasoline. So,
and then stop the intimidation, you know, when, Freudian psychoanalytic.
Oh, I mean, I have family members. Someone wasn't doing well in school and they put their child on meds. And they said it worked because their grades went up afterwards.
You know? Great.
So what if, I mean, who's to say those grades are the standard that you judge this by? My thing is you don't put a 14-year-old on drugs.
Absolutely. Well, you know, that's just poor parenting, because the question is, well, what are the long-term effects on his serotonin and dopamine production?
Yeah, and it's hard to, you know.
Connectivity. And then what about... What about learning the kid learning that, you know, something? If I want to get my grades up, maybe I should work harder.
Work harder, or maybe even maybe the school environment she's in isn't good for
yeah,
her.
Yeah, exactly.
Ever think you about know, that? I mean, there's all types of things.
It's an all gender, you know, free for all. It maybe that's just get the kid out of there.
So you dull her mind by drugs. So she, it's just again that goes back to that just dependence on professionals, expertise, science, you know, the scientist and the. It's the, you know, the technocracy of these things. Well, who am I to judge? I mean, after all, I mean, these doctors have been to Harvard Medical School,
and right, exactly.
And you and Cameron, look at his resume. Who am I to judge him?
World Psychiatric Association president. So you're gonna, when I tell you to get on the sofa and let me give you electroshock, you're damn well gonna do it.
Yeah, I'm a doctor. See,
this is the thing, is that they've never atoned. They don't have any empirical science or. Almost none. So you just have to assume the malevolence is still full throttle, mm-hmm. and it's coming right at you. And then on the other side, it is what they're trying to do is generally can be seen as satanic. It is an attempt to attack the soul. We want to make the soul strong, right? This should be a cultural prerogative. When the kid is doing poorly at school, this is an opportunity to develop what? You know, an understanding of the third axiom in geometry? No. This is an opportunity for the kid to learn to develop some grit, to become tougher, yeah. Right? To become more mature, because you go, look, it's tough. You got to apply yourself. I'm sorry.
That's what I was told.
Yeah. You know, but you just do the best you can, and you'll see you'll get better at it. Well, when you replace that with the drug, with the med, and the kid on Adderall suddenly gets a higher math score, what have you achieved? Well, you've achieved the destruction of the soul. The soul has been destroyed to some extent.
Yeah.
You see, the brain, which and the relationship between the brain and the spirit has been damaged by the drug, because that's what drugs do. That's why they're called chemicals, mm-hmm. because they're artificial. They cannot do anything in the body other than create an unnatural effect.
And it is self-perpetuating, because in these schools with these kids have maybe they have more troubled home life because of the sexual revolution, the toxic environment. So they come to school, then maybe they're not disciplined, maybe they have trouble at home. But instead of acknowledging that reality, because that's being judgmental, that's being normative, they have psychiatrists on staff that we all pay for, which are there to dispense the pills and apply the proper diagnosis, which is take this and shut up.
Yeah, you know, the correct introductory course for every college student should be the protection of the soul, and it should outline, you know, what you really have to be aware of that is going to be attacked by the group that I would refer to as the Satanists, and in their effort to destroy your soul, they're going to go after your brain with meds. They're going to go after your sexuality with pornography. I mean, there's just a list of things that are soul destroyers, right? Mm-hmm. And they're pretty self-evident. So maybe we should go to Harvard. Do you think we could write to them and say, Tim and Joe want to come and teach the course? I have a white coat.
We didn't... Didn't they give Betty Friedan a position in the university to teach, despite the fact that she only had an undergraduate degree or something? So I guess I qualify.
Yeah. I mean,
I guess I
sure
qualify.
You are you kidding? We can whip up a degree in a few minutes. Don't worry about that. I mean, the thing is, we should apply for a Rockefeller grant and then ask the New York Times to put us on, you know, give us some publicity, because we're here to develop a stronger soul nation, a nation of stronger souls. And this should really, we're bringing it back, because this is you know what really, when you look at psychiatry and what and you look at the process, which we talked about, you know, from going back basic all the way to freaking Palmerston and the opium wars, you know, when they started to get at the soul of people, basically what they're really trying to do is to create zombies. Is there what really the real purpose of all this is just is for you to have no consciousness. You'll be functioning as a robot in some way, in some business related, you know, field, but you won't have any soul. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to rebel, turn off the soul destroying elements. You know, that would be a good show, Tim, I think, to go through this. Because, you know, when you think about, like, rap music, pornography, even the Hollywood kind of anti-hero films, mm-hmm. I mean, you can do a really, you know, good kind of collection of things for the, like, a little primer for the college student of things to, like, try to avoid. And then on the other side, we could come up with stuff to, like, develop the soul, to make the soul more vivid, more mature, more robust, you know, being sober, going through tough times, you know, when you have a breakup with someone, that write sad love poems rather than, you know, take meds and cry and then but come to the other side knowing that you can go through these experiences, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things we could come up with, but.
It's, yeah, but in order to write prose, they have to learn how to read and write, and they're not doing that anymore. So.
You always, every time I try to come up with a suggestion, you step on it, you know? I mean, I have no good ideas.
Now they tweet something, like, you know, I don't
know. Uh-oh, brother.
So, okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
All right, Tim, I guess that'll do it for this week. But anyway, let's develop our souls this coming week.
Yeah, I got shock therapy in the morning, so I gotta.
I gotta get. Yeah, me too. I gotta get my meds organized. All right, brother.
Okay, take it easy. Enjoy the weekend. Bye bye.
Yeah, you too. Talk to you soon. Bye bye. Thank you.